Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax reform 2.0 to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can find these podcasts on YouTube at youtube.com/Doug McConey. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, we're back in PwC's brand new studio in Washington, D.C., where I'm excited to have Rebecca Lee, an international tax partner in our Washington National Tax Services practice who specializes in cross-border financial transactions. She's back for her fifth visit to the podcast. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, Rebecca, let me congratulate you as the second member of the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast Five Timers Club, where you're joining Pat Brown in this esteemed group. I do still hope to give jackets to you guys, but I'm sure you understand how the supply chain issues are making that difficult.
I'm just here for the swag.
Oh, you and me both. So before we continue our discussion on crypto, Rebecca, I was hoping you could give our listeners some insights on your experiences as a mom with two working parents of special needs children during the pandemic. I know you're anxiously awaiting FDA approvals for younger children to help put your mind at ease. Well, what's that experience been like as we get back into the office, and what advice do you have for other working parents?
Man, it's been a huge exercise in empathy, both for myself and for other folks, because at the beginning of the pandemic, school shut down, and all of a sudden we were in the situation of running Zoom school for two kids, plus occupational therapy, speech therapy, feeding therapy. And it was a lot to balance, especially when two folks are trying to balance doing their own client workload at the same time. And I found that I had to be a lot more vulnerable and a lot more honest than I normally would be in terms of what my schedule looks like, so that I could really give folks a heads up when I could be on a call, when I would be on a call but not on camera because I was also helping someone with school, or where I was going to need time to just block out and do my work because I wasn't getting those pockets of time during the day when I could really focus. I find coming back into the office now, by the way, huge luxury, especially in our delightful new offices here in DC. But more importantly, the idea of really giving people room to accommodate everything that they need to do in their life and knowing and trusting them that they'll get their work done.
Well, it's really admirable what you and your husband have been able to do and accomplish. And it's great to be able to see you and welcome back. And are the kids back now in school, and are things getting somewhat back to normal?
They are back in school, which is amazing. And I've never been so appreciative of teachers and the occupational therapy staff at their schools. It's amazing. But it doesn't feel like we're quite back yet. So maybe by the end of the year, a couple of vaccines and I'll actually be able to go to the supermarket without it being a massive undertaking.
Right. Well, here's hoping things will get back to normal as slowly as that's happening. So let's move to the topic at hand, cryptocurrency. If you can believe it, it was back in August of 2019, Rebecca, I think it was your second visit to the Cross Border Tax Talks that we chatted about cryptocurrency, where we gave an overview of what crypto and blockchain are and some of the key U.S. and foreign tax issues. I'd encourage our listeners to go back and listen to that if they need a refresher. But before we get into some of the more current topics, are there any general updates on how cryptocurrency is taxed in the U.S. since those pre-pandemic days, which seem like so long ago?
Yeah, I mean, the IRS has actually been fairly active in this space, really with an enforcement agenda. So the IRS's enforcement agenda is called Operation Hidden Treasure, if that helps sell what exactly they're looking for.
Interesting.
And the focus has been very much on folks who are not fully reporting their gains on the disposition of cryptocurrency. So there was a series of revenue rulings and then chief counsel advices, which are more informal guidance, detailing that when you receive an airdrop or there's a hard fork or you're exchanging one type of cryptocurrency for another, that all of those are taxable events. They create income and the corollary, you need to pay tax on them. So certainly from an IRS lens, this is less about our typical clients we'll chat about later in the session and more about individual users and making sure that they're paying their fair share.
Makes sense. So then let's move to U.S. tax reform 2.0. We've spent a lot of time thus far on the podcast talking about these different proposals. Obviously, the goalposts are still moving. We're recording this here in the beginning of November. Still a lot of uncertainty as far as exactly what's going to get passed, when it's going to get passed, if it's going to get passed. But what proposals do our listeners need to consider related to cryptocurrency?
Sure thing. And there's a couple of baskets, crypto specific provisions and just things to keep an eye on. So in the crypto specific provisions, the proposal is to extend the so-called wash sale rules to cryptocurrency, foreign currency and commodities, which really means that I can't buy Bitcoin or hold Bitcoin, sell it at a loss and immediately rebuy it and take my loss currently from a tax perspective. There was a ton of press coverage on folks doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. So these provisions aren't necessarily a surprise. What was a surprise was also the addition of a constructive sale rule, which we have for stocks and securities, which basically says if I hold an appreciated now digital asset and I enter into a short position, a short forward, a swap, that is going to trigger tax on my cryptocurrency holding. And the rise of cryptocurrency derivatives on a variety of exchanges has made this transaction a lot more likely, sure, especially for folks who are early adopters. There's also a provision that's crypto adjacent, let's call it, 6050W, which are the rules for payment organizations and when they have to report certain kinds of sales. Mm-hmm. Those rules are given a longer effective date for what's gonna be more robust reporting. We keep our eye on this specifically for non-fungible tokens because these rules can have a massive impact on that market. And cryptocurrency companies aren't any different than any other company. So I would plug your earlier podcasts on the changes for GILTI. Mm-hmm. This is an inherently international business, right, and most folks have operations outside the US. So thinking about how all the general international changes are gonna affect their business, when the classification of these assets as intellectual property of some kind is gonna be highly relevant in where they slot into the new regimes.
And what is the effective date for those? So you had mentioned that the reporting requirements, there's some time, but what about those constructive and wash sale rules?
So they're going to be applicable for transactions entered into on or after the end of the year. Okay. So basically, calendar year 2021 is going to be relatively safe for those kinds of transactions. I think the thing to keep an eye on, though, is systems upgrades. So right, for most clients, particularly who are trading in high volume in this space, it's not so much just the awareness that they can have wash sale issues going forward, it's the ability to flip the switch and be able to track them on a real-time basis.
Got it. So let's move to some trends in cryptocurrency, because this is really, I mean, since even just the last 2 years, I mean, this stuff is in the news regularly. One of the things that I found particularly interesting was El Salvador, okay, that recently, I guess, changed some rules to accept Bitcoin as legal tender. Okay, what does that mean? And then I want to talk about some of the practical implications that we're seeing our clients related to that.
This is super nerdy and so much fun because it goes to the heart of what is money. So El Salvador, over the summer, with an effective date of September 7th, enacted legislation to make Bitcoin legal tender, which means it can be used for any sales transaction, purchase transaction, the payment of compensation, the payment of their national debts. And the country bought a huge reserve of Bitcoin to basically act as the equivalent of like treasury currency.
Interesting.
And so there's all this legal meaning to being legal tender. And from a tax standpoint, if we step back, we've got IRS guidance that dates back to 2014 that says we don't know much about cryptocurrency, but it is not foreign currency under 988. And now we have this change that sort of has a country, a sovereign nation, adopting a specific cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, as legal tender. And the 2014 notice specifically caveated that it is not, the reason that it's not foreign currency is because it has not been adopted as legal tender in any jurisdiction. I don't think this is coincidental in terms of really getting us to think about, is this now something that rises to the level of a transactional currency? And for my Gap colleagues out there, they were very worried, does this also implicate things like, could I have a Bitcoin functional entity? Because now that this is legal tender, I can establish a functional currency. Like,
right,
isn't this, yeah, amazing? I mean, there are some really practical impacts to this as well. So setting the fun stuff aside, retailers, folks who sell consumer goods, either directly or into the supply chain in El Salvador, had to gear up almost overnight to be prepared to accept Bitcoin as a medium for payment. Because essentially at any shopping location or for any on-seller or reseller, you had to be prepared to be paid in Bitcoin.
And do we think this is a trend? I mean, can we anticipate, you know, other countries? It is interesting that a small country in Central America started this, but it seems like this could be something that other countries might consider.
Well, it solved an actual real world problem, which is like during the time during the pandemic, from a monetary policy standpoint, the US government flooded the market with tons of US dollars to keep interest rates low. And the effect of that is if you're a market that has adopted US dollars, your functional currency, like El Salvador did in 2000, you're in a situation where the US dollar is rapidly depreciating, mm-hmm. but you aren't getting those dollars flooded into your banking system, into your economy. And the trade-off was, frankly, people sending money home. Your dollar didn't go as far at home. And so this was an attempt to solve the problem of a currency, the US dollar, that was really devaluing in local terms. So other jurisdictions that use US dollar either as a dual currency, in addition to accepting a local currency, or as an informal currency, may find that adopting a cryptocurrency helps bring them a certain amount of stability. So I think it's definitely something to watch.
Interesting. So you had mentioned one of the consequences of companies that do business in El Salvador having to gear up to be able to accept Bitcoin as payment for inventory and consumer goods. What about more broadly outside of El Salvador as crypto as a settlement option for accounts receivable, account payments? I mean, just generally using Bitcoin now as a means for transactions.
I can't be more excited about this. And in part, if you check out the 2019 podcast, I mentioned, hey, intercompany settlements for accounts receivable, accounts payable. This is finding real world application because if we think of cryptocurrency just in general as a use case, the thing you can do is you can settle a transaction in an hour that would normally take multiple days for settlements. And from an intercompany standpoint, think of your large multinational that has a monthly netting process because they can't get everything aggregated in one place at a single time until month's end. The ability to settle things in real time with an immutable ledger of those settlements that you could then turn over to local tax authorities and demonstrate payment has huge applications. And what we're finding really practically when we talk to companies, there's a huge amount of effort that goes into AR and AP monitoring, tracking, and ultimate settlement. And this is a way of automating and using smart contracts to really take human being hours and effort and risk out of the system. And it's got application with third-party AR and AP as well, because if you think of the risk you run into in collections from individual sales, the ability to do that via smart contract and collect in a much quicker turnaround solves collection issues that can really cause problems for companies.
Well, you had mentioned the fact that now this is a currency, for example, in El Salvador, the potential 988 implications, right? And to remind our listeners, 988 is generally the transaction that taxes or provides the mechanism to tax foreign exchange gain or losses. You know, one of the challenges that we have in these, you know, accounts receivables, account payment type of netting is tracking the foreign exchange gain and losses. Same thing with just longer term structural notes. You know, what are some of the implications? Does 988 now apply? I mean, what are some of those practical implications with this kind of new currency being added to these types of systems?
Well, one of my favorite things about the pending legislation is the fact that they created a defined asset class, which is digital assets. So any digital representation of value that basically is cleared via blockchain or similar technologies. And the reason that's exciting is because when they added it to the wash sale rules, they added a separate rule for foreign currency, which I do think sends an implication that at least Congress, similar to the lines the IRS was thinking along, doesn't think that cryptocurrencies or all cryptocurrencies are the same as foreign currencies that are issued by a foreign central bank and backed by the full faith and credit of that government, which is the main difference between something like Bitcoin, which isn't backed by anything. But I still am going to have a degree of volatility. If I structure an intercompany loan denominated in Bitcoin, our easiest, most accessible use case, I'm going to have fluctuation every period, both from a financial statement standpoint and from a tax standpoint. And whether that's ordinary gain or loss, and frankly, is eligible for the more preferable rules under the subpart F versus guilty regime, or is just a property transaction that results in just gain, the economic gain is still there. So we're sitting on risk, it's just of a different kind. I think that the real power of this is that, setting aside your long-term loan example for a second, I can speed the ease of settlement so much so that I'm not looking at 30, 60, 90 day or longer receivables hanging out there. I can have things where, because I don't have something that's outstanding long-term, I just don't have the same amount of volatility.
Interesting. And is that something that would be appealing to treasurers then, to effectively try to eliminate, if you will, some of that just natural FX gain that we see kind of in more traditional markets?
It's been really interesting because I think that this has a lot of appeal somewhere sitting between the treasurer and a lot of times the operations or the technology team, because treasurers sometimes like to be able to use their existing tools and like the idea of having lots of money on hand and balances outstanding, because it gives them something to hedge if we're thinking about net investment hedging, or otherwise allows them access to be able to manage risk in the way they want to manage risk. I think operationally for organizations, though, if you're thinking about headcount and risk, this is something that allows them to really streamline places of their business that have been really problematic. So I think there's a certain amount of growing enthusiasm, but I think there's also a big educational curve that folks need to sort of spend the time with this asset and get to know it.
Sure. And you had mentioned hedging. Is that an option as part of Bitcoin? And I appreciate if we're talking about very short-term duration turnaround, we obviously would need a hedge. But if we're talking about maybe longer-term structural notes, I have a hard time even wrapping my head around this. But is that presumably something that could be hedged? And is there even a market for that?
Yeah, great question. So Bitcoin futures have traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange since 2017. And Okay. Now there's a load of regulated exchanges that list them, including the ICE and Ledger X. So there are exchange traded products, and there's a huge growing market for cryptocurrency derivatives. So there's absolutely the instruments out there. They all present a degree of risk, and frankly, in many cases, they're not available for sale in the U.S. because of the regulatory environment in the U.S. So you end up in these difficult situations of, I've got exchange-traded futures as my main hedging option in the U.S. I may have a broader array of mm-hmm. transactions available outside the U.S. So it's a big yes, but we've been talking about Bitcoin because it's easy to talk about and right. listeners mm-hmm. know about it. There's over 4,000 different cryptocurrencies, and if you go a little bit broader and think about all kinds of different tokens, it's an 8,000 plus market. So we're just using a use case to illustrate where folks may even create their own intercompany token as a means of intercompany settlement mm-hmm. rather than picking something that's off the shelf where you're taking essentially third-party volatility.
Fascinating. So one of the other industries that's been particularly impacted by blockchain is the insurance industry. And we think about digital underwriting, insurance, NFT insurance cards, so the underwriting issues. Maybe talk about that, because I think that has some real kind of practical implications, and it seems like they may be a little ahead of the curve. That industry might be a little ahead of the curve compared to some others.
So one of my colleagues likes to refer to this as the digitization of trust, which I think is just fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I think what you end up thinking about are all the different ways when an insurance company underwrites a risk. How do they get the information that's relevant? How do they prove ownership? If I have house insurance, how do they prove that I own my house? All of these touch points that could be maintained on a digital ledger or a decentralized ledger rather than through a centralized ledger. And better information, better data aggregated can allow better underwriting decisions. And this has sort of all of these outreach implications for, could I apply for and get insurance entirely in a decentralized way? How would an insurance regulator regulate those kinds of activities? Outside the US, it's been really interesting to see sometimes this can allow insurance underwriting cross jurisdiction, which I think gives us tax folks sometimes a little bit of heartburn, mm-hmm. because if you've got someone in one jurisdiction doing business with someone in another, you're implicating two different local tax systems and the potential for withholding, as well as base case taxation and indirect taxes. I think one of the funnest things when I think about it, my biggest touch point with my insurance company is my insurance card,
right?
Like for my car insurance. The ability to have that digitally and to be able, if I have a fender bender, not just to take a photo of someone's insurance card, but to be able in real time to be able to prove that that's real insurance that they currently are current on. And so I can automatically link to their insurance company and maybe even then link into the app and put in my claim. That's amazing. It's just an extension of where the technology is today. And it really, all of this is about speed of execution and accuracy and the ability to verify the data in ways other than through a centralized ledger. So I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, the non-fungible tokens, I think, is particularly interesting as a way to have kind of this unique digital card, if you will. I mean, we've heard about that. I mean, there's been a lot written about, you know, voter identification cards, potentially as an NFT, even vaccination cards, you know, just really anything, driver's license that you need to be able to prove. that you are the owner, if you will, it creates some really interesting practical implications. And certainly the insurance industry and those insurance cards, I think, is just one of those examples.
And to bring it back to a totally tax nerd topic, we've talked about the idea of like digital identity. So imagine that I could have a walking, talking equivalent of a W-9 that has all of my identifying information and all the tax relevant information for me when I make an investment, when I onboard to my favorite cryptocurrency exchange or online securities platform. The ability to provide all of that is a huge barrier to entry right now on a lot of platforms, because if you're being compliant, you're collecting a certain amount of personal information and relying on all that individual pieces of data. If I could have that all aggregated. And I'm a little passionate about this. I've been talking about digital identity since like 2014 as a way of solving the no one wants to fill out a U.S. tax form.
Yeah, fascinating. And just being able to gather that information electronically and digitally. So this kind of all goes to the point of crypto really moving mainstream. And I'm going to move back to Bitcoin. But recently, the SEC approved Bitcoin as an exchange-traded fund. What does that mean, and what are some of the implications of that?
Well, this just brings together a lot of things that I care about. So first, when I'm not doing crypto or international tax, I'm also a long-term mutual fund tax partner. And this is the first exchange-traded fund qualifying as a mutual fund that's been approved for trading and has been trading. So this is a momentous period where now if I'm a retail investor who says, I don't want to open up a wallet, I don't want to go to a cryptocurrency exchange, but I want to get cryptocurrency exposure, I want to participate in the Bitcoin market, which has been going up dramatically, and I want to do that through products that I recognize and platforms which I'm comfortable investing through, this really brings it to the retail investor. And the average tax rate for a retail ETF investor based on investment company institute information is about 28%. So this is really bringing it to an audience that are not the super high net worth individuals. This is bringing it, well, I did explain it to my dad the other day, so it's bringing it to folks like my dad who might not otherwise access these kinds of products. So it's exciting, but it also brings a lot of the type of disclosure risk that I think folks are really careful about, making sure folks understand that this is a really volatile asset and they're taking a huge amount of risk investing.
And what are the tax implications of holding a fund of that type? Or is it still all of the kind of general issues that we have? Is it a capital asset and those type of uncertainties? Because obviously when we're dealing with mutual funds, we understand, at least I understand, kind of stocks and bonds and, you know, how 1001 applies to those types of transactions. But how does that work when one of these funds really represents a cryptocurrency?
So it's going to work the exact way that you're used to, which is what's so cool about it. I mean, and in general, in the cryptocurrency space, you just bring all of your normal rules about property and what is a disposition event. But if I'm invested in a Bitcoin ETF that qualifies as a mutual fund, I have capital gains and losses when I sell. I receive distributions, which are in general taxable as a dividend. I might have return of capital distributions, and I might have short-term capital gains distributions. So for me as an investor, it's going to feel the same as an S&P 500 ETF. Some interesting things pop up if you're a foreign investor, because I may be investing in something that's not inherently a U.S. asset, but I'm investing through a U.S. mutual fund and I'm going to suffer 30% withholding on distribution. So it's really something that you have to be an educated consumer to know what you're buying.
Almost brings it into the mainstream from a tax perspective, right? And presumably that, as you had pointed out, will make a lot of investors more comfortable potentially with investing in something like this. All right, so let's move to non-fungible tokens, NFTs. One of the things that I'm particularly fascinated about this is when I was a kid, Rebecca, I was a big baseball card collector. Loved baseball cards. Man, I wish I would have hung on to those things, but I did not. I sold them, I think, in my late teens for not as much as I probably should have. But the concept of the using an NFT as a baseball card, of having a unique digital card, is something that obviously has taken off. We've also seen things like in-game tokens, and one of the things I want to ask you about is NFT land grants. But can you talk a little bit about kind of what you're seeing in the NFT space and how that's kind of changing in the current environment?
This is such an exciting area, and not so much because of any specific use case, but the idea that an NFT can be anything. Mm-hmm. So I can have my digital baseball card, and that can be the same thing that I end up putting a wrapper around my house and sell my house through a smart contract. And it's all, at the end of the day, the same technology. But in general, where we've seen the use cases be the most popular or the most exciting, we've absolutely seen the collectible space. And so it's your baseball card, but it's also
art, right?
It's art. It is Top Shot. It's, you know, athletes making that photo of them making the great shot. It is meme, the memeification, and the huge amount of sort of investment driven solely by the interest in memes. But it's also been a place where we've also been able to wrap experiences in it. So it's not uncommon for some of these like sports-based ones where you can get through an NFT, I get the baseball card and a meet and greet at a certain game. And so it's combining both something that looks like maybe a little capital asset or a personal use asset along with an experience, a service. So the tax geek in us is constantly looking at these and saying, well, the sale of the non-fungible token itself, I have to characterize that, but what if it's a bundle of rights that can be separately consumed? Do I have to go inside of it and break those out, which have different sourcing rules and timing rules and characterization rules? And particularly, I think that you get a different answer if you're the creator. So you're the artist selling your work, or you're the team that is lending player time to be able to go to a meet and greet, versus if you're Doug, the baseball card enthusiast, who is just buying these, holding them in their digital wallet, and then selling them in the secondary market.
And presumably that would be, in that example, that's a capital asset, and to the extent I have basis and amount realized, that would determine the amount of gain that I would, or the amount of tax that I would pay based on the gain that I have in that particular asset.
Absolutely, and the whole thing about them being non-fungible is that they're all really different. So you're gonna track basis specific to this baseball card, this piece of artwork, this digital print. Which puts a huge burden on data quality.
Right. Yeah, it's. I think it's still hard. I was having a conversation to go back to our parents. Like I was trying, my mom was like, can you explain to me what this whole NFT concept is? And it is a bit nebulous, right? To be able to explain, well, through the blockchain, we can create something that is very unique, not even very unique, that is unique, right? And that we can establish that there's really only one of these things that exists on a digital platform as opposed to something that can be copy and pasted. And I think it is hard for some people to get their heads around. But once you can understand that the blockchain can really create this unique thing, then there's all these various applications that we've talked about, from insurance cards to baseball cards to art. And it seems pretty obvious to me that this is a trend that's going to continue. And there's just a lot of practical applications that I'm sure we haven't even considered at this point.
I'd agree.
So one of the other things that is very interesting is that there's a big event taking place in New York called NFT New York City. And so, you know, one of the things is that, you know, this whole digitization, this unique digitization of NFTs is really creating a separate asset class. So what is that? What's going on at that conference? I think it's taking place as we speak here in early November. But what does that mean for the industry?
Well, there's a couple of things. So the first thing is it just means like it's like a lot of things that this used to be a relatively niche event like a number of the other cryptocurrency events. And now I think it's getting a fair degree of mainstream coverage. People are excited about this as an asset class. I mean, shoot, when I'm trying to explain NFTs to clients, the first thing I start with is, have you watched the Saturday Night Live skit on NFTs?
Right.
And if not, I'll send you the link because I think it's like the best description. But I think the second thing is all of these use cases that we've been talking about and then a host that we haven't even considered, these are really enthusiasts and developers and investors all getting together to talk about what the future of this asset class looks like. And those are the types of events that great ideas come out of. Additional daylight gets shown on really great applications or the use. I was listening to a podcast this morning about digital photography and this, the NFTs in the photography space being a huge place where there might be growth. So it allows artists to be able to get their work direct to consumer in a way that actually pays them fairly for their work.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense.
I mean, it's really just exciting. And I think that folks are bringing a level of enthusiasm to just the idea of how do we take this technology and its core fundamentals and make it better and more reliable? Because as much as I'm geeking out about use cases and photos and baseball cards, underpinning all of this is the quality of the technology, which really means cyber and security and making sure it actually works and it's not going to be subject to hacking. And it's not going to be something where your asset disappears because it's a digital asset and it's only as good as the cryptography and the underlying protocol to which it relates. And that's where I think also folks are spending a lot of time together is how do we make this an ecosystem or multiple ecosystems that last?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this continues to evolve. So what I want to move on to is the impact of crypto on capital markets and specifically DeFi, so decentralized finance, and how that is impacting banking and the financial industry. We spent a little time talking about insurance, but talk a little bit about DeFi and what that means to our capital markets and specifically those in the traditional banking business.
So cryptocurrency as a substitute for money immediately leads you to think of how does this substitute how I interact with my bank, my credit card company, my other financial institutions. And what DeFi is fundamentally is what it sounds like. It's decentralized finance. I can, as a holder of wealth or value, I can essentially store that in a platform, make it available to provide liquidity to others. People can borrow from that liquidity pool so they can access the equivalent of credit, or I can exchange or transact. And so DeFi as a, and that's a broad umbrella that includes a whole bunch of different kinds of protocols, has the power to create essentially a digital bank account. And I think one of the reasons that it's caught folks' attention is twofold. So first, there's a huge generational movement around the idea of, I mean, we've been talking about banking the unbanked, especially in emerging markets for like a decade. Mm-hmm. This is really more even in developed markets, the idea of folks not wanting to hold all of their wealth in traditional financial institutions, wanting to have a diversity of risk, or even to a certain extent, just liking the idea of doing businesses with companies that they believe share their values. And so, and not to make it generational, but like a lot of Gen Z look at decentralized finance and different protocols as a way of participating in a financial ecosystem where they can also be a builder or put their net worth to work in a way that feels meaningful. And so when we have that conversation, it becomes a brand discussion and a very interesting one if you are a traditional financial services company or any other kind of traditional services company where you say, how do I reach that next generation of consumers? Who's gonna wanna buy my stuff or use my platform? How do I make it cool? And I'm not cool. I have never been cool and I'm not gonna start now, but I can recognize when the cool kids are doing something. I look at my children who will be potential consumers. My kids are Gen A, which is the generation after Gen Z, and what they're gonna look at their entire life is they are digital natives. They have never had a universe. They could use an iPad before they could spell. So this is a generation of folks who don't view necessarily traditional finance or the traditional banking relationship as sacrosanct. And they don't necessarily make qualitative judgments around the brand and safety that they get with going with a large financial institution versus going with an emerging technology company. So it puts a huge burden on companies to say, how do we pivot our strategy? Do we build? Do we buy? Do we incorporate? Do we distinguish? I mean, there's always the age-old trope about if you're not disrupting someone, you're getting disrupted.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening there, but it takes us back to a discussion around trust and safety too. So everything I said about NFTs is going to be true about any platform. I rely upon my financial institution to make sure that my money is safe, and I rely on the FDIC to insure that deposit. I don't have the equivalent of SBIC insurance in my DeFi protocol. Mm-hmm. So is it the protocol itself and all of the systems that are built into that and the way that transactions are approved that is helping me feel comfortable with the safety? I think there's a huge amount of effort that's put in by developers to make sure that there are bells and whistles that support that. And what it really does if you're a consumer is you have to be able to distinguish. Once you've decided that I'm going to go into a platform, a protocol, you have to be sufficiently knowledgeable, not just about the rate of return, because you can go out there and look at like a lot of DeFi protocols are paying 6 to 13% return on your money, which is greater than the zero that I'm currently getting on my checking account. Mm-hmm. It can be really attractive, but you really have to kick the tires on, is this a protocol that is sufficiently reliable where I'm going to be able to get my money back, I'm going to be able to get my return back, and I'm going to be able to exit, especially where the way that I get that return may not be paid in US dollars, typically isn't, or even in US dollar pegged stable coins. It may be credited to my account in the native token for that environment. And my ability to sell that and get my money back is going to be based on which platforms or exchanges list that token for sale. I mean, this is really exciting stuff and can be massively disruptive, but, and because I hang out with our risk and reg guys a lot these days, consumer, if you will, safety, transparency is top of mind. And I know a lot of the discussions that we have with our clients who are expanding into this space, both technology companies, traditional finance, they're looking at how can I do all of this and not just stay on the right side of the regulatory agenda, both state and federal, but be best in class. A lot of our clients are trying to make sure that they build a better space for their customers to transact in. So how can they be an active part in engaging with the regulators in this space?
Yeah, a lot for the regulators to chew on in this area. So maybe we can wrap things here, coming back to tax. And would love to get your thoughts on kind of where things may be going from a tax perspective, both in the U.S. as well as outside the U.S. You had mentioned some of these proposals in the Build Back Better plan, which, you know, provides some additional guidance, but still a lot of open and unanswered questions as I think about it in our last podcast. So maybe we'll start with the U.S. and then what are you seeing outside the U.S. as certain trends, and where are kind of the tax rules heading for these various types of investments?
That's a big question.
It is.
Starting with the U.S. specifically, I think that there's been a lot of focus on the enforcement agenda. It's kind of where we started. There are a number of stakeholders in the industry who've been really actively engaging, whether it's on the Hill or it's with the IRS and Treasury, around what are the issues that are going to be needed to address next. Mm-hmm. So once we get past sort of the gating, do we have information reporting, staking is a big part of every single protocol that I talked about runs, except for Bitcoin, really runs on a proof of stake network. And for you to stake your coins, which is critical to making the network run.
And what does that mean, stake?
I basically make them available. I pledge them to support the folks who run nodes or validate transactions to be able to prove they're going to do their job.
Okay.
And if there is an error, if there's a validator mistake, you get slashed, i.e. you lose a portion of your coins. So it's a way of making sure, it's a way of building consensus without having to have a bunch of different servers all running the same program at the same time to be able to prove consensus through running essentially complicated math problems.
Okay.
This is all of the future of tokens is run in some variation of this. You get paid for doing that on your coins. You get staking income or rewards. We have to know how that's taxed and the timing and the characterization. Is it UBTI if I'm tax exempt? Mm. If I'm a foreign person, can it create ECI if the protocol developer's in the US, if my node's in the US? It's these classic questions we've struggled through in the technology space around locations of servers, extrapolated globally. And these are the types of issues that folks are really trying to engage with our tax regulators in the US about, because at the end of the day, most folks want to be compliant and they want to pay tax and they want to pay in withholding. They just need a little bit of guidance around how to do that. So more to come in the US. Now let's look globally for a second. DAC 8 was issued, which was a solicitation for comments around information reporting on crypto, kind of a tag along to DAC 6, which gives us a huge amount of disclosure around things like derivatives.
Which is relevant in the EU.
Relevant right. For the EU. You've got the OECD has an open project on digital assets, including information reporting, the relevance for the common reporting standard, and frankly has been really an active participant in dialogues with the industry around rule writing. And then you've got I know we have a crypto practice in 170 different jurisdictions. So in each of these jurisdictions, local tax authorities are taking a brand new look at this. And a lot of times it's indirect tax leading the way. So think VAT or financial transaction tax, but it's also then looking at the core. And many jurisdictions have existing rules, are welcoming and giving rulings. So we always talk about like all politics is local. At the end of the day, when I'm working with clients who have these operations with a global reach, the first thing we're doing is looking at the exact countries and jurisdictions they're in, and we're pulling in our local network, because you can have the same transaction. It can touch three different jurisdictions through the course of closing, and I can get three completely different tax answers. So the pace of change is rapid.
Well, as those developments happen, we'll bring you back for more exciting information on crypto and how it's taxed both in the U.S. and globally. Rebecca, thank you very much. Always a fascinating discussion. I always feel like I come out a little smarter after these, so thank you. So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. Thanks again to Rebecca Lee, an international tax partner in PwC's Washington National Tax Services practice. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.